Congress and President Trump reached an agreement last Friday to fund the federal government through February 15th. But with the issue of border wall funding still up in the air, another partial shutdown could be around the corner.
During the last stalemate, groups like the National Endowment for the Arts, the Smithsonian Institution, and the National Science Foundation were deemed non-essential services and had to close their doors. In a recent opinion piece for the Washington Post, our next guest says America's founders saw knowledge-based services as vital to democracy and that the Trump administration has repeatedly tried to dismantle the country's intellectual life.
Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is the Merle Curdy Professor of History at UW-Madison and the author of the forthcoming book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, you've got an argument about what happened in the short run and then about the long run. Let's start with the short run. What do you see as the impact of this shutdown that just ended for now on intellectual life in America?
Well, let me take this in two parts, if I may. So let's take it up till last Friday, midday. Mm-hmm. So before the shutdown ended. And that was... where to begin? Basically, the funding got cut off to so many of our museums. So the Smithsonian Museums, it got cut off to the National Science Foundation and many other data collecting agencies, federally funded agencies. And so what happened? It meant that everything came to a shutdown. It meant that our collections in the Smithsonian's, which is the world's biggest complex of museums, was shut down. Shut down not only to the public, but also researchers. What that meant was that scientists who were federally funded were not able to access their data. Were not able to conduct their research. Researchers couldn't have access even through websites to some of these collections. So and then we can go on from there. Our arts programs pulled, traveling exhibits pulled. That was then, and now. I've been in touch with a number of people. So now that it's back up and running. It'll take a while to figure out what the long-term damage is going to be, right? So for the historian who couldn't access the archives, he can go back in. All right, he lost a week or two of his research. For the scientists who have lapses in data collection, that's not clear what's going to happen as a result of it. Traveling exhibits that were put on ice, it's not clear what's going to happen to them, and what the longer-term financial consequences are going to be.
And you write that you are concerned about the Trump administration, not just during the shutdown, but in its approach to information, data, knowledge collection.
Well, unfortunately, it's not just the Trump administration. This has been part of the GOP's platform for quite some time now, for the last couple of decades. But the Trump administration is just carrying on a long-standing pattern of wanting to make... reduce federal funding for things like the NEH or the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, public broadcasting, your livelihood. In their last budget, they wanted radical cuts to it. And we'll see if that happens again this year. I expect that that'll happen again this year.
And then let's turn to the big picture. That's the wider point you make in your piece is that these sorts of things have been a priority since the founding of the country on. Can you talk about some of that history?
Yeah, that was something, it's a piece that I wrote for the Washington Post, and of course we're constrained by only so many thousand words. But the point that I wanted to get across in that is that this isn't a partisan issue. I mean, that this is, if you look back historically, as you said, since the founding, Whigs, Democrats, progressives, Republicans. I mean, this was something that all Americans could rally around really up until the last 20 years or so has that been an issue. But yeah, in terms of our founders, you can't not find a founding father who did not think that the free circulation of knowledge was crucial and the production of knowledge, right? So not just circulating knowledge that we were able to carry over in ships from Europe, but rather knowledge that was produced right here, right in America, right on our own, native grounds here, and that production and circulation of knowledge was crucial for distinguishing citizens from subjects, right? So if we're going to have people who are going to rule themselves and self-rule, they need a baseline set of knowledge, facts, understanding, and conversation. So the movement and sharing of that information in order that they can exercise what it means to be a democratic citizen. So they thought this was just a fundamental part of democratic practice.
Can you talk about some of the institutional ways that that took life in the early 1800s and on?
A couple of the things that I mentioned in the piece, one was the founding of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And this was founded by John Adams and James Hancock and a couple of others who wanted to have a place that would basically foster, you know, humanistic and scientific research as well as exchange. And it was also a way to announce to the world, we've arrived. Yes. Yeah? So no, we not only have our political freedom, but we also have our intellectual independence. So the optics of that was very important to the founders. Another example is when Adams became president. This is when we have the founding of the Library of Congress in 1800. So that originally started out, again, the notion that if we're going to have enlightened representation, then our representatives need access to, you know, the latest law, the latest literature on science, the latest political theory. And so in 1800, the Library of Congress was founded with that idea of enlightened governance. But it didn't take long for it to actually reach out and become something that was supposed to be available to all American citizens.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen, a professor of history at UW-Madison, talking about U.S. government support, U.S. founder support for intellectual endeavors, scientific, civic, and more. You said it wasn't a partisan issue for many years, decades for that matter. Why do you think it became more of a partisan issue?
Well, I think that, I think that's a complicated answer, but I think we can clearly identify the period when things really turn around, and that's during the famed culture wars of the early 90s. And I think a number of things went into that, which made public funding of the arts and the humanities in particular, not the sciences, not the natural sciences, but the arts and humanities, a real kind of hot button issue in public discourse. As you might recall, there was the battle over the Mapplethorpe exhibit. So, you know, federal funding for what some reasonably argued was pornography. And why is the federal government funding, you know, an exhibit in what's essentially pornographic photographs? There was the big debate over the bombing of the Enola Gay and at the Smithsonian, and there was an effort to kind of show both the good side of that story but also the darker side of that story, you know, and try to give the full range of facts about what happened. But that caused a huge public uproar in some cases by former veterans of World War II who were offended, and others, you know, in their name, you know, sort of offended that there would be a negative version to the good war. You know, this was the good war. And then there became the history debates. And so this became a very kind of public debate about what is this federal funding going to, and whose version of history, whose version of art? And there's a very clear logic for many Republicans who are small government Republicans who might, you know, legitimately make an argument, which is like, the arts are fine, you know, history is fine, all of that is fine, but that is something that should be privately funded and not publicly funded. But the conversation was very, very, very contested and kind of metastasized from there. And I really think that's a turning point in both where we see sort of pressures on funding towards these sorts of resources, as well as the sort of charged conversation around them.
We are talking with UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen about her recent op-ed in the Washington Post looking at the government shutdown and its effects on America's intellectual infrastructure.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does it worry you that groups like the Smithsonian and the National Science Foundation are often considered non-essential during government shutdowns. Do you agree with our guest that spreading knowledge is vital to a healthy democracy? If you're a researcher, scholar, how have shutdowns affected you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our talk with Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, UW-Madison history professor, about the latest shutdown's impact on America's intellectual life.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. In the short run, do you worry about what happens when archives, research foundations, museums, and more get closed down? Do you think society needs more of a reverence for and support for knowledge and the organizations that make it possible? Do you have a question for our guest based on what she said so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Jennifer, we've seen the phrase marketplace of ideas out in the public eye a lot, and the idea that why should the government put its finger on the scale? A concern that in funding various kinds of research, universities, and more, maybe that's skewing us in one way or another.
Sure, that's a concern of some, and I think it's a legitimate concern of some. I guess I would say two things. One is I've never been much a fan for the phrase marketplace of ideas because marketplaces are often not places of free exchange, right? I mean, there's constraints. There's have-nots. There are people who have access to resources, those who don't. So I think the marketplace metaphor, I think, is problematic. The second thing that I would say is that if someone's going to make a call, you know, some administrator somewhere or a group somewhere is going to make a call about what's going to get funded, what isn't. Of course, all of these decisions are highly vetted from lots and lots of experts and often a lot of public input. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you think that knowledge, both the production of it as well as the free, you know, circulation of it, is crucial for the well-being of our democracy, then there has to be a space in the public, right, as part of the public domain, the public good, that is fostering this, supporting this, and serving as a structure for it.
And I think you mentioned a distinction in some cases between, okay, maybe we can support science and technology research. We see an economic benefit. The idea that you're talking about going back to the founders, that this sort of general intellectual endeavors are good for us as citizens, that might feel, I don't know, distant from people today. Do you want to make the case that it shouldn't feel so distant?
I would hope that, I mean, our listeners here, that every one of them at one point has stepped into one of our fabulous federally funded, you know, museums or archives. The National Archives houses our very own Declaration of Independence, you know, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. These are the founding documents. And that's a public good that belongs to the public. It doesn't belong in a private museum. It doesn't belong in a private sphere. I just think that, I say this both also as someone who researches this to see how my sense of this isn't just, I mean, yes, it's my opinion, and my concerns as a private citizen, but it's also my what I'm learning as a researcher, that this is a priority that has been axiomatic for so many Americans up until our day.
Do you think, actually, I want to go to a caller now before we run out of time. Valerie is with us in Cross Plains. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Valerie?
So I work here in Madison at the National Wildlife Health Center. It's part of the Department of the Interior. And I think when people think about Department of the Interior, they might just think about national parks closing. But what we do at the Wildlife Center is we investigate diseases in wildlife, including when there are unusual mortality events that we have to respond to right away to find out what's going on. And we look for pathogens that might affect, besides affecting the wildlife, which is important in itself, but also domestic animals or human health. And we're not able to do that when the government is shut down.
So your work was closed down while you were doing that? Or while the shutdown was going on?
Yeah, we could not do that during the shutdown. So if there had been an event that required immediate diagnosing of what's going on, we couldn't do it.
Valerie, thank you for calling in and sharing that story. That's one of many worries you had about the shutdown, Jennifer.
Those were precisely what Valerie just shared with us, was the sort of thing that I was hearing over and over again. And that's sort of what, by humanistic researchers as well as scientists like Valerie. And I thought about that. And in fact, even to do some of my own research, I tried to access the Smithsonian, and then the Skull and Crossbones pops up and it says, shut down, sorry, we're closed. And I thought, what does it mean for us to communicate to each other, as citizens, as well as to the world, that these sorts of, this sort of work, like the work that Valerie is doing, is not essential, is not essential for the functioning of our and vibrancy of our democracy.
In our last few moments, thanks for that call, Jennifer, do you think that maybe the shutdown will highlight this kind of work and maybe swing the pendulum in another direction?
Oh, I would love to think so. I would hope so. But one does not need to be a professional historian to know that we're living in a very charged political environment and highly partisan environment. So it'll be interesting to see where this debate goes through February 15th.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about her recent piece for the Washington Post looking at the impact of the latest government shutdown on knowledge-based organizations. We'll be talking to her probably the next month or two about her new book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History.
Wisconsin has a shortage of quality, affordable housing, but people with disabilities often have fewer options. Phoebe Petrovic reports on one group of parents taking unusual steps to help their children with disabilities find housing tailored to their needs.
On a Tuesday in Mount Horeb, five women have gathered at a cafe table crowded with coffee cups and thick binders.
Why don't you talk about your homework? So my homework is...
Today, they're talking about grant applications. Some are specific.
Oh, here's the one. Do not use grant funds on posters and excessive begging.
The group needs to raise $500,000 to help build an apartment complex they're calling Home of Our Own. These parents and grandparents all have adult children with disabilities who still live with them. The group's leaders, Marianne Omakin and Susan Wallach, met over 20 years ago when their children, Amy and Frank, were in preschool. Amy and Frank both have autism and are nonverbal. Wallach says she and Omakin often spoke about their children's futures.
What happens when our children grow up, and where are they going to live, and what are their lives going to look like? Because we know these are not going to be children who are going to be independent someday.
Amy and Frank are now in their mid-20s and still live with their parents, but Omakin knows their children can't live with them forever.
Let's face it, we are going to die one day, and we would much rather plan thoughtfully and to not have the planning be driven by a crisis.
The parents worry about what will happen when they're no longer able to care for their children. And they say they don't want to put them in group homes or isolated apartments, worrying it might expose them to abuse. People with intellectual disabilities experience sexual assault at a rate 7 times that of those without disabilities, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. So Omakin says that for the past 6 years, the families behind Home of Our Own have met weekly, trying to figure out how to build a place where their children can live on their own, safely and affordably, among friends and neighbors in rural Wisconsin.
This is a really, really determined set of parents, and we just refused to give up.
They dreamed up a specific plan, an integrated community in small town New Glarus, welcoming residents of all abilities and incomes. Disability advocates, nonprofit developers, and state officials all say there is a shortage of affordable, accessible housing in Wisconsin. Even without a detailed wish list, it's slim picking, says Jason Belongi, assistant director of Access to Independence, which serves people of all disabilities and ages in South Central Wisconsin.
There's a very significant shortage of housing stock that is both affordable and accessible for people with disabilities.
In the past few years, the state has seen an increased demand for supportive housing, like Home of Our Own, where some residents get assistance from caretakers. That's according to the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. David Ginger oversees their allocation of tax credits for affordable developments.
I suspect I could allocate all my tax credits to supportive housing for the next couple of years and still not make a huge dent into the need.
Home of Our Own has applied for these tax credits, which would largely cover the $8 million project. They've also gotten approval from New Glarus. They have secured a plot of land and drawn up building designs. Omakin says they're getting closer.
Oh my gosh. In some ways, it feels like this has been the longest journey of our lives. But in other ways, it feels like all of a sudden it's moving really quickly. Yeah.
It's been tough, but Susan Wallach, the group's other leader, says their children have kept them going.
Our children are the most amazing teachers, and they're the most remarkable people. And if we are strong, it is because our children have taught us to be strong.
If the parents succeed, they'll create 40 new homes in Wisconsin. But advocates say there are still thousands of people needing quality, affordable, accessible housing. And to answer that need, it'll take more than just a few dedicated parents. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest says it's time to reform the Electoral College in a way that both parties could support.
Have you heard of this thing called the Internet of Things? It has everything from refrigerators to cars to, yes, blenders getting online connections. A cybersecurity expert tells us why these connected products are creating big new risks for hacking.
And an expert on college finance tells us why middle-class families are being priced out of higher education at many schools.
All that, plus we'll take a look at some of the latest news stories of today. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.